Okay. So one of the main problems in neurobiology is to try and understand how neurons undergo or produce changes in the behavior of an animal, and changes that last from a few minutes to hours to days or even permanent ones. And in a variety of sort of simple systems where this sort of thing can be worked out, it's clear that there are changes in the intrinsic electrical properties of neurons that control those behaviors. I can stand over here, this should go over here. So this is the sorts of different types of patterns you can get in neuronal excitability. Some neurons have short, skinny action potentials. Others have broad action potentials. The height of action potentials varies a lot throughout the different types of neurons. And the thing that's interested our lab for a long time is that you can actually change the shape of an action potential in a neuron, either with neurotransmitters will change the shape of an action potential, or hormones, or, and this change in action potential shape can last for minutes to hours or become fairly long-lasting. And this has a variety of implications. If it happens at a neurotransmitter release site, then a broader, longer action potential usually results in more calcium entry, and therefore you get more transmitter release, and that's a mechanism for certain modulations.
What are the examples where that's been studied?
Well, one of the most famous ones is the Eric Kandel's gill withdrawal reflex, where sensitization of an animal produced serotonin on a motor neuron, and that on a sensory neuron, which broadens the action potential, causing more release of neurotransmitter, making a more powerful reflex.
But they can only measure that in the summer, right? How do they know it's actually broadening the release of?
They're inferring that. And in fact, I'll show you.
Unbelievable way?
It seems hard. In what I'll tell you later, we can actually record directly from the endings. So we'll.
So how wide are we talking about?
Oh, so it varies enormously. In certain neurons, the spike is a few hundred microseconds. Whereas in peptide-secreting neurons, in which this happens a lot in neurons that release neuropeptides, that can be tens or even hundreds of milliseconds sometimes. So, and the change in width is usually no more than 100%. It can go broadening.
So the aplasia we're talking about is like doubling.
In one of the neurons that we work with, which trigger a series of reproductive behaviors, that broadening of the action potential can literally go from like 20 milliseconds to 200 milliseconds. So it's, in that case, it would be 10 times the width that really changes. And that lasts about half an hour following stimulation.
So that was aplasia?
That's aplasia, yeah. But
okay, so the action potential to begin with is slow in aplasia.
It's slow in aplasia because it's at 14 degrees, and it's, yeah, that's right. In fact, much of what I'll be talking about is regulation of action potentials in vertebrates. So the other way you can affect a change in the intrinsic excitability of a neuron is you can change its spontaneous activity. So even in the absence of any synaptic activity, neurons can be endogenously silent, or they can pace repetitively, or they can fire in bursts. And the frequency and nature of these bursts varies substantially. Neurons that typically burst are, again, either neurons that secrete peptides, because neurons that use peptides as neurotransmitters seem to require bursts to release the neurotransmitter. So most of the pituitary and hypothalamic neurons are capable of doing this. But also all sorts of rhythmic activities like breathing. There are neurons in the brainstem that have the capacity of bursting endogenously, and the rate at which they burst contributes to setting the respiratory rhythm. Also, locomotion in a variety of animals seems to be regulated by neurons that have some capability of endogenously generating rhythmic bursts of action potentials. And again, depending on the right sort of stimulus, you can switch neurons from being silent to firing repetitively or bursting. Finally, the way you can shift a neuron is to change the way it responds to a synaptic stimulus. Some neurons, if you stimulate them repetitively, will continue to fire while you're stimulating and then become excited for a prolonged period of time after you've stopped stimulating, and even generate prolonged bursts of action potentials spontaneously. Other neurons will only fire as long as you're stimulating repetitively, and then when you stop, they'll stop firing. And the other sort of response you can get is that neurons will respond only at the beginning of a stimulus and then rapidly adapt even though you maintain the stimulus. And many sensory pathways, like olfaction, have neurons that have this property in them. In fact, there's another variant where neurons actually don't fire at the beginning but start to fire if you continue to stimulate them for a while. And again, this is something that's very plastic, and it can be switched by the right sort of synaptic stimulus or the right sort of hormonal stimulus to a neuron.
So these neurons are the first ones to fire stable?
Yes, that's right. So a group. So a group of neurons that I'm not going to talk about that we study in the lab contribute to a change in the behavior of the animal, particularly set off a series of reproductive behaviors. So normally they spend hours, days, actually, completely silent. But if you stimulate them with a synaptic train for about 10 seconds, they become spontaneously active and they'll fire repetitively for about 30 minutes. And the transmitters that they release, which are mainly peptides, act on other neurons in the nervous system, and they orchestrate the whole sequence of reproductive behavior. So they're like a master switch for a series of behaviors. Other neurons that will do this are found in the mammalian hypothalamus. There's the oxytocin and vasopressin secreting neurons can switch between different states.
Those motor neurons, supposedly, Keane and Alcard, they've shown that motor neurons do this
sort of thing. There's actually quite a few examples, I think, of where you can actually switch the behavior of a neuron.
Are you conducting
cells that are responsible? Yes. So I can talk about what. So let me tell you what I'm going to tell you about. This is modulation of the way the neuron responds to a synaptic. So this is a synaptic response. It's a response to this stimulus. Here you're synaptically stimulating the way it's responding to the stimulus. And, very similar. So when this happens, this is usually associated with action potential broadening, but they're independent channels that produce that. So again, in the neurons that we study, there's a non-selective cation channel that opens up less through sodium, potassium, and calcium, and that's responsible, that becomes activated by the stimulus, and that produces a tonic, long-lasting depolarization. And at the same time, there's certain enzymes that get activated, like protein kinase C, that inserts new calcium channels in the plasma membrane, and the action potentials become broadened. So even though they usually go together, that they may be separate molecular mechanisms. So this is the sort of thing that our lab's been interested in for many years. And at the root of all of this is the complement of ion channels that are in the plasma membrane of the cells and how they get regulated. So the three types of ion channels that you need to consider for generating these different types of responses are sodium channels, calcium channels, and potassium channels. And so far, for sodium channels, there I think are now 10 genes. No, it's 11 genes. Calcium channels, there are 10 genes. And for potassium channels, they're somewhere between 70 to 100 genes.
Those genes that have been sampled, so far.
We may be getting to the real numbers in terms of genes, yeah. This is in one person. Yes. In human, yes. Well, this is so Drosophila have less. So for, okay, let me actually...
Can you tell us why potassium has 70 more genes than zinc?
About...
Why potassium has 70 more genes?
Yes, I'm going to tell you why I think that there are so many more genes. And to give you a quick answer, I think it's because you need to modulate the electrical excitability of neurons very precisely. And the way you do it is with potassium channels. It gives you a lot more flexibility. They're responsible for the repolarization of the action potential, and they set the trajectory between action potentials. So you're right. So I haven't even started about splice variants, and I think I'll say a little bit about splice variants. But
the potassium family is thought to be the oldest.
There's a lot of debate about the evolution of this. My guess is that the earliest are probably the non-selective ones, the non-selective cation channels that let through sodium, calcium, and potassium, and then selectivity sort of evolved from that. And I haven't mentioned non-selective cation channels because those genes are only just being discovered. These 70 to 100 different genes for potassium channels fall into a variety of families. And the first family to be discovered was the Shaker superfamily, which consists of four different genes called Shaw, Shab, Shallon, Shab in Drosophila. And there's about 30 to 40 different genes in mammals. So there's been a lot of gene duplication in mammals for those things. They have six membrane-spanning regions, and between these, the fifth and sixth, there's a loop that's called the P domain, the pore domain. And these proteins are, in fact, tetramers. So if you were to look down on one of these channels from the top, you'd see four different proteins, and the pore of the channel that lets through the potassium ions is formed by the internal facing P domain in each of the four channels, four channel subunits. What makes potassium channels unique in this respect is that the sodium and the calcium channels also look like this. But this is one protein in these cases. So a sodium or a calcium channel looks like four of these strung together on a daisy chain. And one gene means one channel. In contrast, for potassium channels, you can make yourself a potassium channel by choosing the first member of the first subfamily, the third member of the first subfamily. You can form heteromultimers, which means the number of possible potassium channels is vastly greater than the number of genes, because an individual channel can either be a homomultimer or a heteromultimer of different potassium channel subunits.
There are only 11 sodium
channels. Right, channel genes.
And in the case of sodium, does it correspond to 11?
Is that
it corresponds with a minor consideration that some of them have alternative splicing. It really it means there's 11 different channels. Because you don't have this flexibility, there's one dominant sodium channel that is expressed in most neurons, and that's I've forgotten the actual new nomenclature for it, but it's the one that's in most neurons. Whereas if you look at a typical neuron, there's no easy way of predicting what particular mix of potassium channels it's going to have.
In general, the rules for combining the monomers?
There are some good rules. The mammalian channels are divided into... KV 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, KV 2.1, 2.2, KV 3.1, KV 3.2, so forth, down onto, we're now somewhere at Kb9. There's a report of a Kb10. And so these are called subfamilies. This whole group of about 30, 40 genes is the Shaker superfamily of genes. And they're divided into subfamilies based on how closely homologous they are. And they're also based on how homologous they are to certain Drosophila genes. But the rule seems to be that you can make a heteromultimer by different members from the same subfamily, but you can't make it by crossing subfamilies, except for a certain types of genes down here. The 9s and the 8s seem to be able to mix with the Kb2s. But with that exception, the dogma, even though it's not totally established, is that these heteromultimers have to come from within the same family.
So when people say delayed rectifier, that could mean anything here?
So these channels are either delayed rectifiers or they're what's called A-type current. Would you like me to explain what an A-current is? Or no, okay. No, none of these are. These are all voltage dependent.
It's only
voltage dependent. Right.
What's the A current?
The A current is basically a delayed rectifier. So the definition of a delayed rectifier is a current that, when you depolarize the membrane, it turns on, and for at least 100 milliseconds or so, it stays on without changing very much. Whereas an A current activates rapidly and then inactivates with a maintained depolarization. And they appear to have slightly different roles. The delayed rectifiers tend to contribute to action potential repolarization. The A currents contribute to setting the distance between action potentials and also the timing from the onset of a stimulus to the action potential itself. So,
sorry, final question on this, just giving up in my mind. Say you make a channel from the first subfamily.
Right.
So are they functionally distinct, the combination with two and one?
Oh, yes, absolutely, yes. So that's how you actually tell that they're heteromultimers, because when the classic way of studying this is you isolate the genes and then you put them into some cell that doesn't have too many potassium channels of its own. And then you find that when you put Kv1.1 together with Kv1.2 and Kv1.3, you get a channel that is not any linear sum of the individual components. And then in the brain, when you use antibodies to pull down Kv1.2, then you find you also pull down Kv1.1 and Kv1.3, that they are bound to each other in the real brain. So, and different neurons have different amounts of the heteromultimers versus the homomultimers. There are a variety of calcium-dependent potassium channels. One of them is called SLO, for slowpoke. It was first found in Drosophila. And actually, this is an older diagram. It's now known to have 7 membrane-spanning regions instead of the 6 that are here. And that's a calcium-dependent channel. There are 4 other genes for calcium-activated potassium channels, which are very different from these. There are small subunits that have only one membrane-spanning region that seem to be able to associate with some of these types of channels and may also contribute to the pore, which is why I've listed them here. Then there are channels called inwardly rectifying potassium channels, which, instead of behaving like the delayed rectifier, which turns on when you depolarize a cell, these guys turn off when you depolarize a cell, and they turn on when you hyperpolarize a cell. And those are very important for setting the threshold at which a neuron will fire. They're also very important in the heart for regulating the heartbeat. And finally, that there are a rapidly evolving new family of channels that our lab has done a fair bit with that have 2 of these pore loops in the same polypeptide. And in contrast to all of these, which are thought to be tetramers, these are believed to be dimers. So it's a two-pore family. of channels. And we actually don't know how many of those there are yet. In C. elegans, there are between 30 and 40 of these genes. So humans may have the same, we don't know. All right. So our lab has cloned a variety of these, and the challenge that we face is to try and understand how regulation of these channels actually fits a neuron for its purpose. And what I was going to tell you about is one of these neurons, one of these channels that our lab cloned, the KV3.1 channel. It's the first member of the third subfamily of potassium channels. How many of these is the structure known? Depends what you mean by structure. In terms of X-ray crystallography, it's basically only the bacterial KCSA channel whose structure is known. It's the only one.
So isn't that any possible combination that will exist? Some of them are just not
similar. Oh, there are many combinations that won't exist. I mean, this will never associate with this.
No, just within those families.
Not every pop thing will exist.
For instance, 4 times 10.
No, it's still vast, but it's no. I mean, in terms of what people have found, KV1.1 associates with KV1.2, and there are channels that have KV1.1, 2, and 3 in them, but no one's discovered a 1.1 and a 1.5 together. Now, maybe it exists, but it's no one has published it. You're right, they can't be sure, but in the papers that we've published so far, they'll use an antibody against all five of them, and they'll see if they can immunoprecipitate KV1.1 with an antibody against KV1.5, and no one's seen that. So you know, maybe they've used the wrong tissue, maybe it's one neuron in 10,000 and they haven't seen it on there.
So it's the estimate of thousands of different types of cancer.
Well, if there's hundreds of, if there's 40 genes and there's heteromultimers, I think it has to be in the thousands. It's difficult to really make a
list.
Right.
If I'm saying in terms of what you think is out in nature, filling all combination space.
I don't think it's filling all combination space. No, I think there's clearly certain preferences that we don't understand yet, but it's still a lot. Okay, so this is now an introduction to what we think this KV3.1 channel is doing. I'm using this just as an example now, but this is a high school experiment that actually duplicates things that real psychophysicists have found. And this is an experiment in which a note was played on a keyboard, 440, the A above middle C. And it was a perfect sine wave, and you wait for a second and play another second where the tone is changed by 1 hertz, so, or by 10 hertz, or by 20 hertz. And then the subject has to say whether the second sound is higher or lower in frequency than the first sound. And this subject didn't do too well, that they were approximately chance level when it was about 5 hertz off the 440.
Zero
means basically that was never tested. So that's the pitch was always higher or lower. And so this person isn't doing too well, whereas this person did extremely well. They could hear 1 hertz difference in those sounds. Couple of mistakes when going from 440 to 439, but it's perhaps not surprising that musicians did better on this than non-musicians. But the finding is that you can take a person off the street who does rather poorly at this, and then within an hour or two or a day, depending on the difficulty of the task, you can get them to improve their performance just by paying attention and making those discriminations. So this can be a learnt behavior, this ability to...
What's the tolerance in a symphony?
The tolerance in a symphony in terms of when you tune an instrument?
How to tune it out to be?
I have no idea. That's an interesting question. Yeah. Okay. Depends on how loud you are, I'm sure.
Because I have, like, my whole childhood, I spent tuning instruments. I don't know.
You should be good at it.
When you sit there for the first, you know, 10 minutes, the whole ensemble, you just sit there tuning.
That's right.
You play, and you go,
if we had sound here, actually, we could test that out, because I've actually got it on the sound files on it, too. Anyway, there is actually a lot known about the neurons that are required for responding to those sorts of auditory stimuli. And that's what I'm going to try and tell you about is how one tests the role of specific potassium channels in that. So this is Kv3.1. which is the channel that I'm going to talk about. It belongs to the Shaker super family of channels. One of the things that interested us about it is that it exists in two forms. There are two splice variants, so the gene can give rise to two different proteins. And they differ from each other in that the longer protein has additional phosphorylation sites for these two enzymes here. And one well-established way now of altering the excitability of the neuron is to activate a second messenger system that phosphorylates ion channels, and that can produce broadening of an action potential or change the way the cell fires. So we were interested in this channel from that point of view, and we wanted to know what the physiological significance of this phosphorylation might be. So this, when you transfect the gene into a boring cell, like a Chinese hamster ovary cell or something of that sort, you find that these channels are indeed delayed rectifiers if you depolarize the membrane potential from minus 80 millivolts to a series of more positive channels of potentials. The current turns on and it stays on. And this is the voltage dependence. As you make the membrane more positive, you get more and more potassium current. So at first sight, this looks like maybe the boring sort of old delayed rectifier that was described in squid giant axon, which just results in the repolarization of action potentials. But in fact, there are two features about Kv3.1 that make it different from the vast other array of delayed rectifiers in the Shaker superfamily. The first is that it's very rapid, so it turns on within a millisecond or two following this depolarization, whereas many of the others take 5 to 10 milliseconds to turn on. And secondly, not shown here, if you return the membrane potential near to rest, the channel turns off very rapidly within a couple of hundred microseconds, whereas again, many other delayed rectifiers turn on within about 5 or 10 milliseconds. So you're probably familiar with a picture of an action potential looking like this, where the sodium current gives you the upshoot, and then the potassium current turns on and gives you the undershoot. And then, because the potassium channels close slowly, you will get this undershoot or the after hyperpolarization following an action potential. So, and this is sometimes called the relative refractory period, because if you try to stimulate another action potential here, it's rather difficult. You have to apply a lot more current than normal. So this is because those currents, the potassium currents, turn off rather slowly following depolarization. This channel turns off very rapidly. It also turns on at rather positive potentials. It really doesn't start to open until you get to minus 10 or 0 millivolts. And again, most potassium channels turn on about minus 30 millivolts, so somewhere about halfway through the action potential. What this means is that this, at first sight, appears to be a lousy sort of delayed rectifier. It can't do a good job in repolarizing an action potential. The first thing is that it doesn't open until you're nearly at the peak of an action potential, because its voltage dependence is all the way to the right. And then it doesn't stay open for long enough to bring the membrane potential all the way back. So it will, in computer simulations, which we've done, made models of the ability of different types of potassium channels to repolarize action potentials. You need about 10 times as much of this channel as you do of most of the other delayed rectifiers to give you good repolarization of an action potential.
It turns on faster than most.
It turns on faster, yeah, which is good. Otherwise, you'd never see anything. Right. But it doesn't turn on until you get to near the peak.
Microseconds.
100 to 200 microseconds. It depends actually on the voltage. The turning off is voltage dependent, so the rate at different potentials is changing. It's turning off more slowly at positive potentials and more rapidly at negative potentials. But all in all, it's rather rapid.
But it's totally turned off before the voltage inspector rests.
Yes, right. Unless you give it so much that even the little bit of residual current.
It's a shame the actual potential I'm getting. Kind of come down and then.
Okay, so this is now in computer simulations. I'm not quite sure which side of this you use, actually. So let's say you have a model cell with a sustained inward current, and you apply different amounts of delayed rectifiers to try and get it to bring the membrane potential back to normal. Let's say here you've got kV 1.3, and then you apply the same amount of kV 3.1. Maybe this wasn't a good example. 1.3 and 3.1 sound very similar. 1.5. What will happen is it'll be activated here, and then you get a new steady state. It won't be enough to repolarize it back to rest. And then if you give it more and more, then you get something that looks like this. All right, so Teresa Perny, a postdoc in my lab, figured out which particular neurons this was in. And it's only in certain neurons. It's present in nearly all neurons that are capable of firing at very high rates. So interneurons in the hippocampus fire at very high rates. They have kV 3.1. Cerebellar granule cells can fire at very high rates. They have kV 3.1. But the highest levels in the nervous system are in the auditory brainstem. The highest levels are, in fact, in these neurons that I'm showing you here. These are in a part of the brain called the medial nucleus of the trapezoid body, or the MNTB. And one of the delightful things about these neurons is that they have enormous synaptic endings. Their endings completely envelop the soma. So with a patch pipette, you can either patch onto the soma and then record from the cell body, or you can patch onto the presynaptic terminal. And the presynaptic terminal is about 30 to 40 microns wide. And you can record directly from the currents in the presynaptic terminal.
So they're driven essentially by very few inputs.
One. The way it looks, it's modulated by other inputs. So here's the cell body with its axon. Here's the presynaptic terminal with one input. And then there's a few fuzzy dendrites out here with smaller boutons that can regulate it. But this particular pathway is just one.
So where is that from?
So that's come from the cochlear nucleus. So let me...
And it's only from 1 year.
Okay, so hair cells and the spiral ganglion project to the cochlear nucleus. And in fact, this synapse from the hair cells onto the... part of the cochlear nucleus that we're interested in look very much like this as well, except here now there are three of these finger-likes, or four of these finger-like things. So now there is convergence down here. But what I've shown you here is the MNTB that receives an input from these neurons, and it's an inverting neurons. These neurons are glycinergic, they're inhibitory. This is excitatory, this is a glutamatergic synapse. So this excites these, and then these neurons in turn inhibit neurons in this comparator pathway here, the LSO. So this pathway compares stimuli coming from both ears, and it receives an inhibitory input from one side and excitatory input from the other side.
So the role you just do is change the sign as fast as possible.
Yes, that's thought to be its major role, yes.
Yes.
I'll show you their firing pattern.
It's one-to-one connections?
It's a one-to-one connection, yes.
So the number of cells in the trapped total body is the same?
No, it's not. Some that there, I think you can have multiple inputs from, in other words, inputs can project to several neurons in the MNT.
Okay, so there's more neurons.
There's more, right. And so this synapse here is very similar indeed, except for the convergence. And these cell bodies also have KV3.1. KV3.1 by EM we know is present in that presynaptic terminal, and it's present in the soma of those cells.
So you're saying it's a 40 micron size?
30 to 40 microns, yeah.
And the morphology is?
Basically round. It's beautiful for modeling because the cell body is basically round except for a few.
Are there many release sites?
Yes, lots of release sites in that sort of baseball-like glove thing that surrounds the soma, right. So it's very high fidelity synapse.
So I'm a little confused about the comparator circuit. So I thought the comparator circuit wants to compare, so it wants to have the same sign from the two gears.
Okay, so in fact, that exists as well in what's called the MSO. So there's two comparator circuits, one which receives excitatory inputs from the two ears, and I just haven't drawn it here. And then there's one that receives inhibitory inputs from one side and excitatory inputs from the other side. So
And then there's opposite symmetry.
Then there's opposite symmetry, that's right. So you get the same thing on the other side, yes. So the simpler one to understand is the one that receives excitatory inputs from the both sides, which is the MSO, that receives inputs from here and here, and that also has this channel in it. And then when they're coincident, you get excitation.
Does MSO have an intermediate station like MSO?
No.
Okay.
It's direct. It's just this is useful experimentally because you can patch on directly onto the presynaptic terminal, which you can't do anywhere else. So all of these neurons in these circuits that I'm talking about have the property of phase locking. That's to say, when you apply a sound wave at anywhere between a few hundred and or 100 and 2,000 hertz, the action potentials locked in time to a precise phase of the sine wave to within a few microseconds. And this is thought to be important for a variety of different things. It's probably important for the perception of speech. It's certain to be important for the perception of tone, which is what that thing was before. The ability to phase lock at 400 and then to compare that to the response at 400 requires that the neurons phase lock very precisely. But in the MSO, in the LSO and the MSO, the main point of this phase locking is to determine where in space a sound is coming from. So if a sound arrives at your right ear somewhat earlier than that in the left ear, you interpret that as coming from the right, even if the sound is louder on the right than on the left. Certainly at frequencies up to 2,000 hertz, it can be louder in the right, louder on the left, provided it gets to the right ear earlier, it'll sound as though it's coming from the right. So timing at those frequencies is everything. And it's because the brain is comparing the timing of arrival of those two action potentials. So the LSO and the MSO are doing that.
But I thought it's not necessarily one-to-one, right?
I'll tell you, that's what I'm going to get to right now. So this works fine when the neurons are firing one-to-one. Now, neurons can fire, these particular neurons can fire at several hundred hertz. And so frequencies up to several hundred hertz, this works quite well. Now, you can phase lock at up to 2,000 hertz, and owls can phase lock up to 10,000 hertz. But the neurons don't fire at 2,000 hertz or at 10,000 hertz. And that's because of what you said, that yes, you get skipping. So now this is a real recording from an MNTB neuron now, and we're just stimulating it at different frequencies. And it's firing 100 hertz, 200 hertz, 300 hertz. Now, this is what starts to happen.
It's a sine wave stimulation?
This is actually a rectangular pulse stimulation, but because this is in a dish.
Which animal?
This is mouse. Yeah, we now do all of this with mouse because then we can knock out genes. So this now, when you get to 400 hertz, it fires 4 action potentials, misses one, fires 3 action potentials, misses one, 3 action potentials, misses one, 2 action potentials, misses one. As you go higher still, it fires at 600 hertz, and now it's not, I'm sorry, it doesn't fire at 600 hertz, it's responding to 600 hertz, but it's firing every other stimulus. So here, the neurons are phase locking absolutely perfectly, and here the neurons are phase locking absolutely perfectly. If you look at the timing here, and I'll show you a little bit of this later, it's pathetic. This is the same neuron, yes. Right. And if you plot the peak of the action potential to the stimulus, there's a progressive delay here until it fails, and then there's a progressive delay until it fails, and a progressive delay until it fails. So this sort of pattern is not very useful for phase locking. But as you go higher, then there's a whole range of frequencies up here where it's firing to every other action potential, and it's phase locking really well. Then you get to a stage where it fires one, misses two, one, misses two, and then it's phase locking really well again. Okay, so
it might be chaotic
in there. So in here, probably will quasi periodic, I would guess. Yes. Right. So these neurons have KV3.1, and we're very pleased to find that when we record from cells that have been transfected with the KV3.1 gene, we can use electronic wizardry to find a current exactly like it in the MNTB neurons. What I mean by electronic wizardry is that we have to hold the membrane potential of the neuron about minus 40 millivolts. When we do that, we inactivate the other potassium currents that are there. And then we step from minus 40 millivolts to a series of more positive potentials, and we get a current that matches absolutely perfectly in terms of kinetics and activation, deactivation, pharmacology, what we see in the transfected cells. And this was reassuring because, as I've already told you, channels can form heteromultimers and there could be all sorts of strange things going on. But in this case, it seems very clean.
Putting blockers at the top, you put in some kind of blockers to block other channels? Or?
We didn't, no. In this case, all we did was hold at minus 40 millivolts, and the other channels that are in there become inactive. We actually put in sodium channel blockers, but not any other blockers of potassium channels, and we didn't need to do that.
It could be the KV3.2 or some other.
You're absolutely right. It could still be KV3.2, which has properties, or KV3.3, which whose properties are sort of similar. That's right. So to do that, we actually recorded from a mouse in which the KV3.1 gene was deleted. So the KV3.1 channel is very sensitive to a potassium channel blocking agent called TEA, and that reduces the current substantially. But if we record from a mouse in which the gene has been deleted, then we don't see any current in this range at all. Now, if we step back to minus 80 millivolts, we still see the other potassium currents. They're fine. But holding at minus 40 millivolts, which inactivates those currents, there's now no potassium current, or barely any potassium current left after the gene's been deleted.
Is this the phenotype?
This is very interesting. So they are they're not very agile. They do really poorly on the rotating rod. They are terrible mothers. They won't look after their children at all. It's sort of interesting because they won't mate. They're really difficult to get them to mate. And it's interesting because auditory interactions are very important for both mating in mice and for mothers paying attention to their young. So we still have a collaboration to work with some people in England who make little headphones that they can put on mice to look at their ability to do all those sorts of things. But that's at least one hypothesis for why they're not that happy. And so this is what this deletion of this gene does to the firing pattern of the cells. The cells, the wild type fire fine at 100 hertz, 200 hertz, 300 hertz. You've already seen how that looks. If we apply this drug TEA, then the cells do fine at 100 hertz, 200 hertz. But now at 300 hertz, they're really sagging. This is a low concentration, for people who are into biophysics, this is a very low concentration that specifically gets the Kv3.1 channel. But with the Kv3.1 gene deleted, the cells already start to fail a little bit at 200 hertz. And at 300 hertz, now they only respond at the very beginning of the stimulus. They fail to respond throughout a maintained stimulus. And the higher we go in frequency, we still only get a response at the initiation of the stimulus, whereas, as you've already seen, when you go to 300 or 600 hertz, these continue to fire. And
what do you mean by fail to respond?
So these are not true action potentials. These are like passive responses. Or
pulses are pretty hot, are pretty strong then.
The pulses are fairly strong, that's right. But this is an action potential here. And then these here are sort of weak responses. These get smaller and smaller the harder you stimulate. Whereas in this case, you just miss out certain responses and get a full action potential each time, as you saw at higher frequencies. So.
Okay, so the number of those doesn't decrease. The amplitude just goes down.
That's right. The number of these doesn't decrease, and they're all of the same size. And as you go up and up in frequency, you just get, they just continue to get smaller. Okay, so that's what we think that this channel is doing for these neurons. It's absolutely required for that ability of the cells to phase lock at higher frequencies, and in order to, in fact, even be able to respond to the higher frequencies of stimulation. So this is the bit now that we've found very interesting, that if you look at the neurons in the MNTB, they don't all have the same amount of this channel. Now, even though all of the MNTB has very high levels of Kv3.1 compared to other neurons, if you just stain these neurons with an antibody for the channel, you find that some neurons have fairly low levels of the channel in comparison with others where there are much higher levels. And in particular, you see a gradient of the channel so that the medial end of the nucleus has much darker staining than the lateral side of the nucleus. And why that's interesting is that the auditory system is organized tonotopically so that the low frequencies of sound come in at the lateral end of the nucleus and the high frequencies come in at the medial end of the nucleus. So neurons that are devoted to higher frequencies have more of the Kv3.1 than the neurons devoted to low frequencies.
What is just the bottom or the bottom of the disc that seems to also to express this channel?
There's some fibers here, and I actually don't know exactly what that is. It sort of cut at a funny angle. That might be some other neurons from the MNTB. That's.
Cochlea is projecting to this, and
yes.
The stiff hairs are going
through the
cochlear ones going to the
lateral. Right. Through the cochlear nucleus, so these are not directly receiving inputs from the hair cells, they're receiving two sets of neurons in there. Right.
Topographical.
Right, exactly. Right. Okay, so this is now a computer simulation that we made of the MNTB neurons, in which we just need to take three currents. We took the sodium current. We took the KV3.1 current, which we could model very accurately, and we also took the other current, the other major potassium current in these cells, which activates at much more negative potentials and which is inactivated at minus 40 millivolts. And with that, we could reproduce basically what we saw with the KV3.1 knockout. This is looking at 100 hertz, 300 hertz. Then at 400 hertz, we get this funny business of 3 missing 1, 3 miss 2, 2 miss 1, etc. And then we go back on track again at 600 hertz. And if you eliminate KV3.1 from the model, then you get the sagging at 300 hertz and the inability to respond any higher to.
Can you change the ratio of KV3.1 to the other channel? Can you get different?
So if you now maintain the other fixed and then look at the ability of these cells to follow different frequencies. So this is now backwards because to match the medial to lateral end. So we've maintained the level of the low threshold one at the level that we actually recorded in the neurons, kept the sodium current fixed, and then simply went from zero up to 1 microsiemen of KV3.1 conductance. And basically, the more of KV3.1 you have, other things being fixed, the higher the frequency you're able to follow and phase lock to. So you can phase lock almost to 2,000 hertz with a high degree of KV3.1, whereas you can only phase lock to lower frequencies before failing with lower levels of KV3.1.
Does this place get skinnier too?
Yes. Well, they should do. That's actually very difficult to systematically measure, which is something we'd really like to do, because the effect is fairly, because of sodium channel inactivation and because of the contribution of the other channel. I'll show you what a complete elimination of the KV3.1 current does to the spikes later. It's a small effect.
The simulations you see getting there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to digress a little bit because what we'd like to know is what determines how much of the KV3.1 channel a cell has, and in particular whether there's any adaptation here, whether you can make the neurons follow particular frequencies and what the neuron has to do to adapt to a particular frequency. So first of all, I'm going to tell you about why some neurons have KV3.1 and others don't. And this all resides in the DNA for the KV3.1 gene, the promoter. Lee Gann, a graduate student in my lab, cloned the region of DNA upstream of the two starts of transcription and found that there are certain pieces of DNA in there that were absolutely essential for neuron-specific expression. And the way she did this was to take this piece of DNA, hook it up to a reporter gene, such as beta-galactosidase, and then put this in all sorts of neuronal-like cells and non-neuronal cells and see what was needed for this to be expressed selectively in the neuron-like cells. And it turns out that there's a region just in the 5' untranslated region, which has an element in it that I won't go into any detail unless it was interested in, which appears to bind proteins in non-neuronal cells and suppresses expression, whereas in neuronal cells, this can be expressed perfectly well. And she also made a mouse in which this promoter was hooked up to beta-galactosidase, and then expressed it in the brain. Cerebellar granule cells express it very well. The MNTB neurons express it very well. So the fact that certain neurons selectively make it seems to reside in that part of the DNA, and we're still analyzing that in more depth.
It's pretty sparse,
except for the MNTB, yes. So much more important, though, much more important for, we think, for the adaptation of these neurons and for the regulation of the response to different frequencies, is a region just upstream of the start of transcription which is a cyclic AMP and calcium response element. This is a piece of a sequence that binds a protein called Kreb. And this protein undergoes phosphorylation in response to elevations of cyclic AMP or to elevations of calcium. And when that happens, the transcription of the gene is enhanced, but it only happens when the Kreb protein is phosphorylated by an elevation of calcium or by phosphorylation by cyclic AMP. And Li Gan showed indeed that this piece of DNA really binds the real Kreb protein when it's phosphorylated and did all that good biochemical stuff. So what this means in real cells is that when you stimulate the cells in any way that results in an elevation of calcium, you get an increase in the transcription of the KB3.1 gene. So this is a cell line that happens to express KB3.1 endogenously. And if you depolarize these cells for 10 minutes with high potassium and then look 24 hours later, you get an increase in the levels of messenger RNA for KB3.1. If you apply a drug that potentiates the influx of calcium during the stimulation, you get an even bigger release of calcium, a bigger increase in KB3.1 messenger RNA. And if you block it, calcium entry with a calcium channel blocker, you can prevent the increase in KB3.1.
What was K86?
BAK8644 is a drug that binds to calcium channels. And you know, when you depolarize a calcium channel, the channel opens up and does this sort of transient flickering of opening that's voltage dependent. In the presence of this drug, these openings become much longer. So each channel stays open for much longer than it would normally have done if you didn't have this drug present. So it's a way of enhancing the effect of a calcium channel opening. You let in several times more calcium as a result.
And KCL is just changing the...
KCL is just high potassium, which depolarizes the cell, so activates the calcium channel.
And just, can we go back one?
Sure.
So how does calcium make Kreb bind to that? Calcium activates?
Yes. Okay. So Kreb, there's an enzyme. It's a kinase. It's a calcium calmodulin-dependent protein kinase 4, which becomes activated when calcium enters the cell. That, when it's activated, it will phosphorylate the Kreb protein. When the Kreb protein is phosphorylated, it'll bind to DNA that has the CRE element, and that will enhance the transcription of the gene. Cyclic AMP will also do so. So cyclic AMP also contributes potently, that's right. But it presumably, it probably doesn't contribute in the deep effect of depolarization. But if you elevate cyclic AMP some other way, you can also get a potent stimulation of this, yes.
Are there many forms of Kreb or just one?
There's, I think, two or three. There's at least two that I know of.
In adults?
Yes, it does happen in adult neurons. Do I have that here?
Make our neurons fire faster.
Yes, that's. Whoops, am I going the wrong way? That. Yes, this is a pathway that is active in adults. Yeah. Okay, am I going?
So depolarization is supposed to affect calcium.
Exactly, that's right. So depolarization, when you depolarize a cell or make it fire at high rates, you activate calcium channels, which lets calcium into the cell. And again, as I said, it activates the calcium-dependent enzyme that phosphorylates Kreb. Kreb then binds to the DNA and enhances transcription. This is showing you the same thing, but now just looking at the activity of the promoter. In a cell, we've transfected the promoter, hooked up to an enzyme whose activity you can measure. And basically the same thing, if you depolarize, you get an increase in the activity of the promoter, and you can block it by preventing calcium entry into the cell. okay, just to really ram it home, this is now, it's a little bit difficult to do these experiments in the MNTB, the medial nucleus and trapezoid body, but there's other auditory neurons just upstream of the MNTB, which are the inferior colliculus, which is sort of sitting on the back of the brain. It's much easier to get at experimentally. And there we can actually really measure the levels of the two isoforms of the channel, the messenger RNA for the two isoforms of the channel. And depolarization produces a marked increase in the levels of the channel. And it also increases in the inferior colliculus now the level of the potassium current substantially. So this is now comparing cells that have been depolarized with cells that were not depolarized 8 hours later. So we depolarize them, record from the currents from the cells after 8 hours, and we find that there's over a doubling of the high threshold KV3.1 light current.
And they're depolarized during that whole 8 hours?
We've done it different ways. It works with just a 10-minute depolarization. These will
wait a long time.
You still have to wait, yes. So we don't know what the time course is. This was 8 hours later, and so this was actually a courageous experiment. I'm not going into the details of it, but what Jun Liu did, she's a postdoc, so she would make the slices, depolarize the cells, wait 8 hours, and then dissociate the cells and record from them. So that's how she got this. And again, this depends on calcium entry. She showed that if you block calcium entry into the neurons during the depolarization, there's no increase in the potassium current.
So she bathed the entire slice in potassium?
Yes.
So it doesn't include seizures?
No, inferior colliculus doesn't see as much. No. So this again is the... It is the model that I was telling about. So the hypothesis we have is that stimulating the neurons at high frequencies lets in more calcium, activates this enzyme calcium kinase 4 that phosphorylates Krebs, that binds to the DNA, that turns on the KV3.1 gene. And one thing I didn't tell you about, but most of the KV3.1 is present at the very edge of these large calyx-like endings. It's sort of situated right at the very edge of the synaptic membranes.
Why is that? Because there is no equipotential.
My speculation for why that is, and we don't, it shouldn't, if it's equipotential, it shouldn't make any difference. That's right. My speculation is that this is also where there's an enzyme protein kinase C is located. That's been shown by other people that the enzyme seems to be located perisynaptically, and it's linked to the glutamatergic metabotropic glutamate receptors, which activate protein kinase C. So it's a metabolic thing, and this is a good position for phosphorylation of the channel, which I haven't told you anything about yet, but which we think is very important.
Wait.
Is there a way to reduce the number of KV3.1 channels?
To regulate it up and down?
Probably down. I mean, probably yes. Probably, but we, in terms of transcription and increasing levels of RNA, we haven't looked at that. But what I'll tell you later is that it's very important to be able to decrease the activity of KV3.1 sometimes. So there must be a mechanism for doing that.
Channels can eventually be degraded?
Yes. I mean, there's always a turnover of channels.
Reduce transcription levels and wait it a while. But...
In fact, it's been difficult to measure the real turnover of channels. Sodium channels, I think, are estimated to have a turnover of about 2 weeks or so. The potassium channels, maybe a few days. But that's what happens when you stimulate more of them. Okay. So now let me tell you just a little bit about how we're testing this hypothesis. So the hypothesis is that the more you use certain neurons to drive them at high frequencies, the more of this channel you'll make, and that could explain the gradient why the neurons that are at the high frequencies have more of the channel than the others, and that's why they're better at doing it. So we can look in animals at the distribution of different proteins from high frequency to low frequency. And I've already told you that KV3.1 is preferentially found at the high frequencies. The Krebs protein itself, the transcription factor that gets modified. That is present completely uniformly throughout all frequencies. There's no distribution of that. But the phosphorylated form of the enzyme, which we can detect with an antibody that's specific for the phosphorylated form, that doesn't uniformly stain all the neurons. In this particular case, you can see that it's staining just the high frequencies, which would what you would expect if you're preferentially stimulating Kv3.1 at the higher frequencies. But that's not what we always see. We always see a cluster of these at different frequencies. Sometimes the cluster's in the middle, sometimes it's at the low frequencies. And one of the things we're trying to do now is to actually expose the animals to different frequencies of sounds and see if we can move this cluster of CRISPR-Cre to different frequencies depending on what they're being exposed to. That would be a prediction of the idea that there's a use-dependent driving of these. Yeah, we could do that too. That would be probably technically more difficult, but easier perhaps to interpret. But if we could do it with sound, it would be a nice experiment. But it turns out that there are animals that go deaf naturally. In fact, quite a lot of mice develop normal hearing, and then in the few months after birth, their hair cells degenerate, so they have no auditory input. And interestingly enough, in those cases, the MNTB is still there, but there's completely uniform distribution of Kv3.1 in the across the tonotopic axis. So that might actually suggest that you actually have gone back to an earlier state. And similarly, if we look at phospho-Kreb, phospho-Kreb is still there in the nucleus, but it's no longer in those clusters associated with different frequency bands. It appears to be a completely random staining of phospho-Kreb in the deaf mice.
These animals showed a gradient before they went deaf, like Kv3.1 and phospho.
Almost certainly. We're still looking at that, yes, because they should do. Their hearing is totally normal at the ages at which we've looked at the gradients. But these are ongoing experiments.
Is the calcium mechanism the same in cells?
We don't know. They have very efficient calcium binding proteins. They have very high levels of parvalbumin and various other calcium binding proteins. In fact, nearly all of the neurons that fire at very high rates have very high levels of calcium binding proteins. No one's reported a gradient of those.
It's more like a Krebs.
Yes, almost certainly. It must regulate lots of other things. We haven't, but then, you know, we haven't looked too closely. There must be receptors and various other things that would be going along with this, yeah. Okay, so far everything I've told you about Kv3.1 is really good. In other words, the more of it you have, the better you are at following high frequencies. And why wouldn't any self-respecting neuron in the world want to have as much of it as it could do? It could then cope with any stimulus that it's given. And so what I'm now trying to do for the next part of my talk is to explain why we think it's important to sometimes rapidly decrease the levels of Kv3.1 or the activity of Kv3.1. And that's where we think these phosphorylation sites come into play.
Would this be a type of break?
Sure, yes.
Decide whatever.
Sure. Okay, so what I was saying before the break was that we think Kv3.1 is very important for the ability of cells to fire at very high frequencies, and that the more of Kv3.1 you have, the better you can do at following high frequencies, and that there appears to be a mechanism by which if you depolarize neurons or drive them so as to let calcium in, the cells will make more Kv3.1. So what I'm going to address now is why you would want to modify the properties of the channel once it's there, and in particular, as I'll show you for one of these phosphorylation sites, why you'd want to perhaps rapidly decrease the amount of Kv3.1. And I think there's actually two reasons for that. There's a presynaptic and a postsynaptic mechanism. But this slide just, in fact, shows you that the protein does get phosphorylated. This is an experiment in which you incubate cells with radioactive phosphate. The phosphate incorporates into the protein, and then you can add drugs that will activate the protein kinase, and you get more incorporation into the protein. So it really is a...
So A and B are...
So A and B, do you remember going back... there are two forms of this channel protein, one that is shorter and one that is longer, and they're both made from the same gene. And actually, they're also both present in the same neurons, but the shorter form is the form that predominates during development and during embryogenesis. Once you start making synapses, this becomes the dominant form. So in the adult, this form with the extra phosphorylation sites is the predominant form, even though there's still some of this left. And so, but both of them are phosphorylated, you can see, by both of these enzymes. And I'm really only going to talk about protein kinase C.
Functional difference between the two?
The two enzymes?
The
real functional difference is that when you activate, and I'll show you this, but when you activate this enzyme at this particular site, you produce rapid decrease in the amount of Kv3.1 current, whereas this one is unaffected by activation of that enzyme. So in fact, we've mutated this particular site and shown that if you just change that one amino acid so it can't be phosphorylated, this can no longer be regulated by this enzyme, and you activate the enzyme and nothing happens to the current. So this shows you basically what I've told you. Now, using single channel analysis, you can see the opening and closing of a single Kv3.1 channel, and you add a drug that activates the enzyme protein kinase C, and that produces a greatly reduced probability of opening as a function of voltage. So it decreases the amount of current. And now we're comparing the MNTB neurons with the transfected cells. So we're comparing Kv3.1 alone, and we add the drug that activates this enzyme protein kinase C, and if we look at the short form, the one that doesn't have that extra phosphorylation site, it's completely unaffected by it. If we look at an inactive analog of the drug that activates the enzyme, nothing happens. But with Kv3.1, you get a 30% decrease in the current. And if you record from MNTB neurons and activate this enzyme, you get an almost identical decrease in the amount of current. Now, remember when we knocked out the current, where we took Kv3.1 like current to zero, the cells were not able to follow high-frequency stimulation above 300 hertz or even above 200 hertz. But the effect of activating this enzyme is much subtler. It reduces the amount of current, but only by 30%, so it's about two-thirds of what it was. And interestingly enough, when Carolyn then looked at what this did to the firing pattern of the neurons in the MNTB, she found that basically it didn't do anything at the low frequencies where the cell fires one-on-one. Where the biggest effect came was at that chaotic, or it wasn't chaotic, pseudo-periodic, whatever it is, regime, where you now start to miss one action potential. Because as I said before, the timing, when you start to fire two action potentials, miss one, three, the timing becomes very variable. So whereas here, every action potential is completely superimposed at a low frequencies, in the control at this intermediate frequency, before you start getting the doubling where you fire one, miss one, fire one, miss one, with this irregular firing pattern, you get variations of as much as several hundred microseconds or a millisecond in the timing of the action potential. And that would be very bad for trying to determine the delay between two stimuli coming into the nervous system. So an excellent question. So that's where theoretical modeling comes in, and I'll get to that on the next slide. But you're right. This we apply TPA, and the response gets a lot better. It's still not perfect, but we don't get these big outliers, and now the action potentials are much more closely on top of each other. And that could be due to any one of lots of things. It could be the other potassium current. So we measured the other potassium current, the low threshold current, and that's not affected by TPA or the activation of the enzyme. But it could be things that we don't know about. So what we did was we went back to the computer model to see whether that's what we'd expect to get from lowering the current by 30%. And indeed it is. So now this is in the computer model where we're getting that sort of pseudo-periodic thing where the action potential delay now becomes spread out. And if we just simply reduce the current by 30%, we can greatly sharpen up the timing. There's another way of looking at this, actually. If we look at the point where the breakup really starts, so this is now looking between 300 hertz and 360 hertz. Here at 300 hertz, the cell is doing fine, but at 350 hertz, it's firing like 10 action potentials, missing one, firing another 10, missing one. And if you superimpose all of these action potentials on top of each other, you find that each one is progressively delayed until you finally miss one. So none of these action potentials has the same timing. And similarly here, if you reduce the amount of Kv3.1 just a little bit, you can now completely set this right. So you're now firing in response to every stimulus. What you lose is the ability to fire at the much higher frequencies. So you can no longer follow 600 hertz, but to this intermediate frequency, you can suddenly follow very precisely. So this is why we think it may be very important to modulate the amplitude of Kv3.1 by protein phosphorylation. As I said, this is something that only starts to happen once the synapse is established, that extra phosphorylation site gets added.
Even at 350, this is locked exactly to the Was it skipping?
It's not skipping here at all. Now it's locking precisely. And at some point, you probably get to the point where it's actually locking for the first 300 action potentials, and then you get a sort of... we haven't actually analyzed this in that sort of detail, but... here it is locking precisely. There comes a point where probably it's...
what happens when it no longer locks?
Oh, then it goes back to the chaotic. It starts looking like this again. So you shift the frequency at which this happens. So if you start going now to 380 or 390, it's on the next slide. But, okay, so this is now the plot I showed you before of the amplitude of Kv3.1 cell versus the highest frequency it can follow. And plotted on the right here is the frequency at which you start to get failures, so that now it's no longer phase locking accurately. The first frequency at which it begins to fail. So the more Kv3.1 you have, the earlier the frequency at which you start to get failures. So if you wanted a neuron to faithfully phase lock at 1600 hertz, it's not going to do a good job at 300 hertz. And the only way you can get this neuron to follow at 300 hertz is to drop the amount of Kv3.1 to a point where it now is going to lock at 300 hertz. So we think this is a mechanism that has to be used if a neuron is going to respond to accurately to a range of frequencies.
There's really only a band of frequencies.
That's right. There's a narrow band of frequencies. That's right. Now, the other thing that should be pointed out is now this is the frequency at which you start to lose timing going from firing one-on-one to in the range between firing to every stimulus and the range where you now start to fire to every other stimulus. But now there's another range when you go from firing to every other stimulus to firing to every third stimulus, where you'd get a similar breakup. And again, the modulation of Kv 3.1 would be required to shift the range.
Why is reducing, in this picture, I would say reducing the Kv 3.1 conductance would actually make things worse as far as falling, because it doesn't totally, I mean, the less current, the less you polarize, and it's, what's responsible for this?
It's too fast and it's not that long.
Right.
I would say if it's too slow, it's not that long.
Okay, so either There's way, it doesn't work.
It's too slow, it can't keep up. And then it gets a skip.
Yeah, it's going to skip, but I mean, let's
figure it out now. The skipping here is actually not, I don't think it's the biggest.
It's not the speed, it's the amount, it's the conductance.
Yeah, I said. Oh, you think it's too much? Over repolarizing?
Yeah, yes. There's too much over repolarization, which actually it's the simplest way to think about it is actually there's too much inhibition here. Potassium currents are inhibitory.
But they turn off really rapidly, I guess.
Well, okay. The reason it's complicated is because this is largely the fault of the other potassium current. And if you get too much activation of the other potassium current, which happens if you get, which does happen under these conditions. And I can explain why.
Now, with pure Kv 3.1, you get rid of the potassium current altogether, everything would be fine.
Then it would be fine, except you couldn't fire at these frequencies. If you get rid of Kv 3.1 altogether.
No, keep Kv 3.1, get rid of the other potassium
current. That gives rise to other problems because the cell then starts to become spontaneously active and ignores your fire. Each stimulus can give you several action potentials, which is a bad thing.
But on this, what you said, if you reduce the 3.1 below a certain level, you will not be able to improve anymore.
Right.
It's a small.
It's a range. It's a small bandwidth that you can arrange. Yeah. Right.
Okay, why can't they? I mean, what's the division between on phase lock and on phase lock? Well, so where is your.
This is phase locking, this is phase locking, this is not phase locking. Phase locking implies that you superimpose the action potentials and every action potential is locked to the same phase of the stimulus. So when you get these irregular patterns, then every action potential is at a different phase relative to its neighbor. Whereas here, every action potential is exactly the same phase with its neighbor.
I'm sure that if you go further away for a higher TKV 3.1, you again get like at higher frequency, you would get again
locking.
Like higher, sure.
Here?
Yeah, you go further.
If you go further, you start to you get this sort of stuff again.
Yeah, but then do we have like
this is
yes, yes. It may come back at a higher frequency, like at 500 hertz. But then when you get to 600,
the other side.
Hmm?
So you
think in the left panel, we have a phase locking coming back, right? At 600.
Yes.
Then in the right hand side, probably you do have that too, right?
Well, not above 600 hertz.
So you have the locking at 1200,
no
higher.
Not with the reduction in Kv 3.1. This will not phase lock at 1200. This may phase lock at 1200, but this won't.
I don't understand why there's that transition. It seems like you have phase locking and the loss of phase locking and coming back to phase locking.
Right.
I don't know, the 600 is now 1 to 2.
Yeah,
but right. I'm saying that for the other, if you go from 1 to 1 and 1 to 2, you can go through these quasi periodic. Yeah, for that.
So it's. I think the point is that they're, so mathematically we would say those are phase locked, but they're not whole number multiples.
Right.
So it's like 350 and 360 would be like, if you look at the, they're phase locked. And
these are not phase locked.
No, but there's a phase drift between them.
But mathematically, I think you might say they're phase locked.
It could be some
mathematical definition,
some really
they're phase locked, but the multiple is really weird.
It could be an irrational multiple.
Some rational number.
Okay.
And if it's an irrational multiple, it's called quasi-periodic. So
okay.
It will never repeat, but it's not classically chaotic.
Oh, no, you're right. This, I think, will repeat. This is a perfect repeating pattern.
Right, and it'll just take a long time to repeat. So this is how locking
many,
at a high point.
How many action potentials
right.
are
yes.
there?
And for the auditory system, this will be not good.
But the ratio there of number of action potentials to number of stimulus pulses is what?
Ratio,
it's
well...
almost 1 to 1, and then it skips, because it's processing. It's a processing, so finally it's in a hole, and it can't come up.
So it would be like 5 to 6.
Yes,
six,
that's correct.
Six stimulus pulses and five action.
Five action potentials, exactly. That's the problem, yeah.
The question is why you think that the lower, the cell with the lower expression actually cannot phase lock with a higher frequency.
Okay, once this happens, once you get to the point where the cell is not capable of generating action potentials because it's being depolarized too rapidly, the cell needs to be able to fire an action potential, recover the membrane potential sufficiently to give you another spike. If the cell, and that's because the sodium channels have to recover from inactivation. So in order to get multiple spikes at any frequency, it's important that the sodium channels open and then get brought back to somewhere near the resting potential so they can recover to give you another action potential. So the problem here is that the cell's being driven too fast and the cell is incapable of getting back to the resting potential because there's not enough potassium current. And so the sodium channels never recover, so it's not capable of firing at these high rates.
So for that cell, from that frequency on, there's never...
From this frequency on, it'll never respond.
360 on the right-hand side, 2 to 1 and 1 to
1. This is 1 to 1. Yeah.
So one hypothesis in coupled oscillator theory is that for a very linear oscillator, you'd be like on the left-hand side, you'd go through mode-locking regions, transition between these fundamental locking, like 1 to 1, 1 to 2, and then in between 5 to 6.
Right.
And then if you get more nonlinear, then you start to broaden the region where you get resonances. So the 1 to 1 gets broader over a different range of different frequencies. You just get sucked into it. Sacrifice is that the more nonlinear you go, then you can die and not fire at all.
Right.
So I mean that might be a mathematical explanation.
So this is what you're calling about dying, and then you're saying this is more nonlinear.
Just more nonlinear.
Yes.
So it can track higher frequencies before switching to the low.
Yes.
Because what happens is they're called Arnold tongues, and they start to broaden as you go more nonlinear.
A couple of oscillator theory apply to this case. It's not clear why changing this conductance would be from the changing.
A couple of oscillator theories are wrong. It's periodically driven nonlinear oscillator.
Okay.
But your concern about mathematical question, from the point of view of the nervous system is clear, something is good and that is bad.
Right.
Right.
From the point of view of the brain.
So there's no free lunch.
Right. That's right.
If you want to lock at 360, the right hand side is good.
Right.
You want to lock it,
but if you
want
to
lock
at
other side is good. Yeah. Which was the point, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay. Band.
But then this thing won't be able to lock it and go to higher frequencies. So then you'll need, there's no free lunch.
Well, except it says then if you want this, then you know, you change the phosphorylation state of the channel back again so you can recover.
But these cells have tuning curves, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
The peak of the tuning curve, the right amount of peak of 3.1, everybody's happy.
Right. Okay. So far, everything I've said is about the postsynaptic cell, the ability of the cell to respond to a certain frequency of input. But I said that these synapses are these very large synapses, and Kv3.1 is also present in the presynaptic terminal.
So just the big picture here, that this was supposed to be a faster form of regulation than changing the number of
channels. That's right. So this can happen within a couple of minutes or so. Yes.
Okay.
Right. And be reversed very quickly.
So this can down and up regulate?
Yes. So this is a much more dynamic moment-to-moment regulation of the amplitude of the current, yes.
The time scale for?
In general, minutes. Yeah. I mean, phosphorylation can occur as rapidly as milliseconds, I mean, hundreds of milliseconds, but generally it takes place over minutes. So we can record the action potentials in the presynaptic terminal now. And this is now applying that drug that blocks the potassium. And this is what you get to the spike width in the presynaptic. A very slight broadening of the action potential you get when you completely eliminate Kv3.1. And we can record currents that sort of look like Kv3.1, but don't 100% match what we see with Kv3.1 in transfected cells. There could be a variety of explanations for that. Our favorite explanation, actually, which I won't go into in detail, is that we think that in the presynaptic terminal, these sites are unphosphorylated, this other enzyme, and that changes the properties. But be that as it may, why would you want to regulate the potassium current in the presynaptic terminal? So one of the important features of this synapse is that it undergoes synaptic depression very strongly. So if you stimulate presynaptically now and record the postsynaptic response and then look at the postsynaptic currents, even at 100 hertz, this you get a marked depression in the postsynaptic currents. And the recovery is very slow. So you can get, for 100 milliseconds of stimulation, you get a substantial depression of synaptic currents. And if you then plot the time course of recovery from this synaptic depression, from a pulse at 100 hertz, it takes over 10 seconds to recover. This is, of course, an extraordinarily slow time course for something as fast as the auditory system. And these cells are firing all the time, and in your brains they're responding right now at fairly high frequencies. But just a brief 100 millisecond stimulus here gives you this very slow recovery. Now, interestingly and paradoxically, if you stimulate harder, you get a more rapid recovery. So if you now stimulate the presynaptic input at 300 hertz, you get more synaptic depression. But if you look at the time course of recovery, you find that there's a more rapid phase of recovery followed by a slower phase of recovery. And at every time point, the response after the 300 hertz stimulus is larger than that at the 100 hertz stimulus.
And amplitude effect or frequency effect? The 300 hertz only gone to 0.4, you've seen.
So we actually haven't done that. We think it probably is a combination. In other words, it depends on how much calcium you let into the cell or not. Right. I think it's going to recover slowly. I think you need to drive it harder to get the, even though we actually haven't done that experiment, the prediction would be that if you gave a shorter number of pulses here, you wouldn't get such a rapid phase of recovery and it would be more comparable to the 100 hertz. And I can tell you why later if you like, or it may come up. So this is, for a variety of reasons, this synaptic depression we've shown is the amount of transmitter being released. It's not a postsynaptic desensitization, and it's not a change in the calcium current in the presynaptic terminal. Okay, now if you apply that drug that blocks Kv3.1, you see something extraordinary. Here is the control that you've just seen in the slow time course of recovery. Here now you've decreased Kv3.1, And now look at the time course of recovery. It comes back within a couple of hundred milliseconds. Instead of taking tens of seconds to recover, this is now recovering within a couple of hundred milliseconds. This greatly enhanced rate of recovery is due to the extra calcium that comes in into the presynaptic terminal with this. Because if we add a very low concentration of a drug that attenuates calcium entry, it's a calcium channel blocker, but not enough to block neurotransmitter release, just to decrease the amount of calcium that comes in during the action potentials. We still have the slightly broadened action potentials now. We still get synaptic depression, but the recovery goes back towards the control values. So what we think this means...
What's a typical fire rate of these cells at Viva?
They fire at hundreds of hertz, and so probably this is going on all the time. They're chronically depressed, and they're at some stage of synaptic depression all the time. Yeah.
You said this is a presynaptic?
This is presynaptic. This is a presynaptic phenomenon, yes, and it's this is the effect of on the presynaptic potassium cones.
You're recording presynaptic. These are all
recorded. These are recorded postsynaptically. They represent the postsynaptic currents that are activated by the neurotransmitter being released from the presynaptic terminal.
How do you have the presynaptic effect?
We did a bunch of things to eliminate the possibility that this was postsynaptic desensitization, which is the main thing. Could be there's a drug, cyclothiazide, which blocks that, and we still get the same effect. And we also tested, by directly recording the presynaptic terminal, that this wasn't a failure of calcium current, which would also be a presynaptic effect.
So if you innovate the total charge transfer in TEA, is that smaller than the
future? The total charge transfer, meaning the across which?
Yeah, the number of transmitter released for that train.
Oh, there would be more transmitter released in TEA. Well, it starts off higher. So if you integrate it would either be the same or more. Because the classic effect of broadening an action potential.
TEA block all phosphorylation.
No, it blocks the potassium current. And this is a low concentration, so it doesn't block the other potassium currents that are present in these cells, and either in the terminal or the thing. It's actually a fairly non-specific drug at multiple millimolar concentration. But at this concentration, it seems to selectively get the KV3 point.
What's the concentration?
Several hundred micromolar to millimolar. And the IC50 is 200 micromolar. So we, in common with everyone else in the world, doesn't really understand what's going on here. But what we believe is the extra calcium that comes in somehow acts on the readily releasable pool of vesicles. And quite how one defines that can vary. It could be that there's a physical translocation of vesicles, perhaps in response to the elevated amount of calcium that comes in during the broadened action potentials, that greatly accelerates the rate of recovery of this thing from stimulation. It could be that there's another pool of vesicles that aren't ready for release until you give them a higher level of calcium. All sorts of ways of looking at it. But what we think this really means for the nervous system is that, again, you have to modulate the amplitude of the potassium current, not only to modulate the accuracy of firing, but also to ensure that this terminal can continue to fire for a prolonged period of time.
Is it known that the amount of neurotransmitter per vesicle is fairly constant?
It is known that that's reasonably constant, yes.
Known or believed?
Believed.
So there's no mechanism that can
believe to be known.
Bigger.
I think the harder you look, the more you'll find of anything. So. This is actually currently one of the most investigated synapses ever, which it was.
So synaptic depression has to be due to some vesicle number.
Yes. Yeah, yes. Yes. That's well established. Yes. Okay. So just in the final seconds. And so I've told you about KV 3.1 and what it needs to do for these neurons and why it's important for these neurons, why it's important that its amplitude is regulated both short-term and long-term. I'm just going to tell you that that's not the only thing in these cells. We've cloned another gene called RTOC, which is a member of these two poor family potassium channels. It's present both in the presynaptic cells to the MNTB, and it's present in the MNTB, and this is localized by a technique called in situ hybridization. And we've no idea what it does. We can't express this channel. We think it probably is a leak channel. That's to say, it's just the resting conductance leak in the cell. And we think that based on the properties of some of other these channels that have been expressed. But this one, we're missing some factor that allows it to be expressed. There's another fun channel that we've cloned called SLAC, which is sequenced like a calcium-activated K channel. This was a graduate student, Bill Joyner, in my lab, who cloned 8 genes during his thesis, and this was one of them. And this looks like a shaker channel with a very long tail, and this we found is present at very high levels in the presynaptic terminals. We've made antibodies to it. It's by in situ hybridization present in hippocampus and cortex, but also at high levels in the MNTB here. And we think it forms a heteromultimer with this other channel called SLO to give you calcium activated potassium channels that are intermediate in conductance between what you get with SLAC and SLO alone. What this actually means is that we think, as I said, this may be a form of potassium channel that is sensitive to calcium, which makes it a good candidate for being in the presynaptic terminal where calcium levels rise very high during transmission. And we think that the interaction between these two channel subunits forms a particular type of channel.
SLAC is from the Bolshevik family.
SLAC actually is its own family. It resembles SLO in certain respects. It has a different number. It has the same number of membrane spanning regions as the voltage-dependent potassium channel. The calcium-activated SLO channel has 7 of these things, and this only has 6. But there's only 7% identity between these two guys. But 7% identity. So it's not very closely related. But the pore region and a little part of this region here, it actually resembles SLO. So there's a region of similarity right here, which made us try the experiment of putting the two together. We found that the conductances were different from either alone, suggesting that they interact and form a heteromultimeric channel.
What are those plus signs on SLO? Is that?
Oh yes. So this is in this region, which is called the S. It's called the S4 region because this is called S0, S1, 2, 3, 4. So this is the fourth membrane spanning region. This was only discovered recently, so they started numbering them here, and then they added S0. That's right. So this S4 region has a very positively charged amino acid, either lysine or arginine, at every third residue. And that's thought to be the voltage sensor of the channel. So if you model the alpha helix, you see all these charges lined up. And the current thinking is that this sort of helix moves as the voltage changes in the field. And so this has a voltage sensor. This SLAC doesn't have that, even though actually this is by itself somewhat voltage sensitive. So the voltage sensitivity must lie somewhere else.
So how, again, does the calcium influence?
So in this channel, calcium binds somewhere in this region and turns it on. So this channel is basically a delayed rectifier whose voltage dependence is regulated by calcium. So if you plot the probability of a channel opening as a function of voltage. This is the conductance. So let's say this is zero. A delayed rectifier has a sort of curve that looks like this. It turns on with voltage. This form of calcium-activated potassium channel is basically a delayed rectifier whose voltage dependence can be shifted by the level of calcium. So as you increase calcium, you go from basically no channel activity, because these are unphysiological voltages, to being open nearly at rest because at higher levels of calcium. Now, not all calcium-activated potassium channels are like that. So the other genes are actually voltage independent. They only care about the calcium concentration. So these are the characters who did all the stuff. Teresa Perney made the antibodies against the Kv3.1 channel. Carolyn looked at the phosphorylation in the channel. Lu Yang Wang did the synaptic recordings. Aaron looked at slack. Bill Joyner cloned lots of stuff. Li Gan cloned the promoter. Jun Liu looked at the inferior calliculus and the regulation by depolarization. Christian von Heen is looking at the deaf mice and the Kreb. Toshi Kanemasa expressed the channels in CHO cells. And these guys we collaborated with on the slack channel. And Ian Forsyth is the guy who developed the technique of recording from the presynaptic terminals. And we collaborated with him on some of that stuff.